Chapter 1, A Tale of Two Worldviews, The Context of the Theology of the Body. In man created in the image of God, the very sacramentality of creation, the sacramentality of the world, was thus in some way revealed. Together with man, holiness has entered the visible world, the world created for him. John Paul II, The Theology of the Body, 1905. What are metaphors? That question haunts Mario, the postman in 1994's Il Postino. Longing to win the heart of the beautiful Beatrice and struggling to understand the verse of Pablo Neruda, the poet who lives on his mail route, the simple postman peppers Neruda with questions about metaphors, symbolism, and why the poet writes what he does. Understanding finally comes one afternoon on a beach after Neruda shares a poem about the sea with Mario. Marveling at the poet's words, Mario unwittingly coins a metaphor of his own. "I felt like a boat tossing around on those words," he says. When Neruda tells the postman he's just created the very thing he's been trying so hard to grasp, a metaphor, Mario at first dismisses the notion. Then, in an instant, he sees. "You mean," he asks Neruda, "that the whole world with the sea, the sky, with the rain, the clouds, the whole world is the metaphor for something else?" Exactly. The whole world is a metaphor for something else. In the film, the words surprise Neruda, but they wouldn't have surprised John Paul II, nor would they have surprised centuries of Catholics who came before him. Those words, in effect, are a summation of how Catholics understand the world. They are a summation of the sacramental worldview. And the sacramental worldview is what the theology of the body is all about. The Church never teaches anything in a vacuum. She has her doctrine, and that's unchanging. But how she talks about it, when she talks about it, and why she talks about it is determined by concrete circumstances in the world. Sometimes she's commemorating a particular event or witness. Sometimes she's correcting confusion, offering reminders in times of crisis, or defending lies with truth. Sometimes she's doing all the above at the same time. The theology of the body is no exception. It is a theology presented in a specific time and place for a specific reason, namely, as a response to the loss of the sacramental worldview in the once Christian West. In centuries past, the sacramental worldview defined Western civilization. The Catholic way of seeing the heavens, the earth, and all they contained was written into Dante's Divine Comedy and trumpeted in Mozart's Requiem. It formed the substructure of Aquinas' philosophy and the substance of St. Francis' mysticism. It manifested itself in the lingering quiet of dimly lit Gothic churches and took shape in all the gilded frippery, soaring domes, magnificent frescoes, and countless images of angels and saints thronging the courts of heaven in the later Baroque. In their own way, each of those things expresses the Catholic belief that matter is never just matter. Dirt is never just dirt, butterflies are never just butterflies, and flesh is never just flesh. All were created by God. As such, all communicate something about God. Everything in the universe, every star, every tree, every body, proclaims some truth about its maker. They are all, as that humble postman recognized, a metaphor. They are all a revelation. Every atom in the universe is pregnant with mystery, pregnant with grace, capable of helping man discover the truth about himself and God. God, however, didn't set his creation in place as an everlasting witness to himself and then withdraw from that creation. Rather, he is intimately present in it, always and everywhere. The sacramental worldview helps us see that, showing us that heaven and earth aren't separated from each other by an unbridgeable gulf or an unbreachable wall. Man may have turned his back on God, but God never turned his back on man. Even in the days before Christ's coming, he was at work in the world, finding ways to speak to man from behind the veil. Then, when he became man, when he took on flesh, loving, suffering, and dying for us, heaven came to earth, and it still comes to earth. Every day in every place where the holy sacrifice of the Mass is offered. Every time Christ's sacrifice on Calvary is made present in time, so is heaven with all its hosts. The veil between time and eternity is drawn back, and the angels and saints worship with us as we kneel before the Eucharistic Christ, which may be the most scandalous thing the sacramental worldview reveals. Not just that God became man, but that God becomes food for man, imparting his divine nature to us, body to body, soul to soul. As the Church explains it, man has fallen, but not irredeemably so. His heart might be black with sin, but when touched by sacramental grace, by God's own life, it can be made clean once more. Man can actually be made holy. He can be transformed. He can become another Christ, not because God declares him so, but rather because through grace, God makes him so, using mere matter, bread and wine, oil and water, hands and breath, all within the liturgy of the Church to communicate his life to man. That's the sacramental worldview. It's a worldview where heaven comes to earth, grace penetrates matter, and every individual story is part of the cosmic story of salvation history. It's a worldview where everything has a meaning, everyone has a purpose, and every moment is accounted for in a divine plan. It is, ultimately, a worldview that says Sartre was wrong and Flannery O'Connor was right. Hell isn't other people. Other people are Christ's. Without the sacramental worldview, there would be no plays by Shakespeare or concertos by Bach, no stories by Chesterton or mythologies by Tolkien. There would be no St. Peter's, no Notre Dame, no Sistine Chapel, no David, no university system, no scientific method. The sacramental worldview made all that and more possible as gifted men and women strove to convey in words, music, marble, and methods the divine splendor of the world in which they lived. Then, that stopped. It didn't stop in an instant. The loss of the sacramental worldview in the West arguably began as early as the 14th century, slowly at first, then picking up speed with the dawn of the Enlightenment. The Industrial Revolution, two world wars, and the social revolutions that followed finished it off, at least in the dominant culture. As for who gets the credit for the waning of the sacramental worldview, well, that's a complicated tale, with a colorful cast of characters that includes the likes of Immanuel Kant, David Hume, René Descartes, Francis Bacon, and William of Ockham. Each of those thinkers, in his own way, had a bit of a struggle with how man can know himself, God, and truth, not to mention just about everything that can't be seen or quantified. Then, as they reasoned their way through those struggles, man, God, and truth, and again, just about everything that couldn't be seen or quantified, were called into question. The end result of their questioning was modernism, a way of approaching the world that recognizes only that which is measurable as real. So gold is real. Profit is real. Corn is real. But God, the soul, the angels and saints, grace and revelation, not real. In denying the existence of all that wasn't measurable, the modernists placed man, as opposed to God, at the center of the universe and declared his material advancement the goal of human existence. With divine revelation dismissed as superstition, modernists instead saw human reason stripped of, rather than illuminated by faith, as the go-to cure-all for all that ailed the world. In reason and its fruits, science, technology, industry, modernist man placed his hopes for a utopian future, confident that if he were just left to his own devices, he could make a heaven out of earth. As Father James Wehner wrote of the modernists, "If only man reasoned hard enough," they thought, "if only the right system of government or economics could be devised, sin and suffering, hunger and disease, war and strife would all just go away." It was a wildly optimistic proposition, but it did bear some fruits. As modernism took hold of the popular imagination, men did come to a deeper understanding of their place in the order of creation. They saw their own potential to create, to grow, to be transformed into someone better than they were. And in that, they caught glimpses of man's great dignity. Likewise, science and technology, which modernism promoted, did improve man's lot in some ways. It's hard to complain about indoor plumbing and dentistry or penicillin and MacBook Pros. all advances made possible by the explosion in industry and innovation the modernist movement helped spawn. Unfortunately, the modernists didn't stick to just manufacturing smartphones. Because the modernists dismissed the possibility of transcendent truth and divine authority, man became the default arbiter of what was true, right, and good. But because not all men see eye to eye on such questions, what was true, right, and good became relative, something for each individual to decide upon for themselves. Likewise, by discounting a creator and any overarching design or purpose to creation, the modernists propagated a view of man and the world where grace infused nothing, where grace touched nothing, where grace did not exist. All was mere matter, to be manipulated, changed, or disposed of at each individual's will. Philip Johnson summed it up when he wrote that modernism ultimately meant, "We can do whatever we like because there is no unimpeachable authority to prevent us." And we did. Modernism, and all the other isms to which it gave birth, relativism, materialism, skepticism, hedonism, and its most confused offspring, which is a mixture of all the other isms, postmodernism, aren't just responsible for sophisticated HVAC systems and women's suffrage. They're also responsible for atom bombs and Uzis, sex change operations and Nazi death camps, contraception and euthanasia. They're the reason the contemporary culture sees bodies as just one more piece of matter to be used or manipulated as individuals see fit, and why youth, physical beauty and strength, not age or wisdom, make a person valuable in the culture's eyes. Modernism likewise explains why sex, children, and life itself are no longer seen as sacred gifts, rich with a divine purpose and part of a divine order, but only as biological events, products and processes to be purchased, enjoyed, or aborted at will. It accounts for the rise of the selfish pursuit of happiness, of doing what feels good when it feels good, regardless of the cost. And it's why the suffering of ailing and aging bodies, of poverty, disease, broken marriages, and wounded hearts has become, for multitudes of men, meaningless pain to be avoided at all costs, never accepted, never embraced, never offered up for our own and others' salvation. In short, modernism bears much of the blame for the particular shape of what's wrong with the world today. It first denied, then supplanted the sacramental worldview, working its way out of the academy and into the homes, bedrooms, and everyday lives of Catholics and non-Catholics alike. The Church's response. Humanae Vitae was, in a sense, a response to modernism. Pope Paul VI's 1968 encyclical highlighted the consequences that would inevitably follow the widespread use of artificial contraception, sounding the alarm about how a mechanistic, materialistic view of the human person, lived out in the bedroom, would change individuals, relations between the sexes, marriages, and entire cultures. The only problem with Humanae Vitae was that it fell on deaf ears. By the late 1960s, many Catholics were too steeped in the modernist worldview to listen to the arguments the Pope made. He appealed to their sense of faith and reason, but among much of his audience, both senses were flawed, corrupted by modernism and its attendant problems. It didn't help matters that when it came to knowing and understanding the Church's teachings on spousal love, not all Catholics found themselves on the same page. Some were well-versed in both the what and the why of Catholic sexual ethics, but others lacked one or both of those pieces. In more than a few quarters, caricatures and confusion abounded. The reason for the confusion, however, had nothing to do with the Church's doctrine. It was more a matter of communication. On the one hand, the Church knew that marital love was a good and holy thing, ordained from the beginning by God. Genesis 1:18 made that clear enough. Moreover, not only did she know that, but over the course of 2,000 years, she went to bat over and over again to defend that understanding against those who said otherwise, the Gnostics, the Manichaeans, the Albigensians, and other heretics of a similar sort. At the same time, the Church also knew that sexual desire was a mind-blowing, mood-altering force that, when not rightly ordered, could leave a culture-wide path of destruction. It could, and did, bring down entire kingdoms. See Troy, while leading countless souls away from God. For the past two millennia, it has fallen to the church to articulate the difference between those two sides of sexual love, between the good and holy and the disordered and destructive, and then help humanity live on the right side of the line. In and of itself, that's no easy task. Throw in the not inconsequential fact that the church on earth is made up of fallen men and women, some with disordered desires of their own, and a difficult task becomes more difficult yet. Through the centuries, some people have been up to the task. Others, not so much. The church's official doctrine remained free from error, but how well the church's sons and daughters understood that doctrine and communicated the fullness of it, well, that was a little less on target. Actually, sometimes it was a lot less on target, even among intelligent and faithful Catholics. Case in point, Origen, one of the great early fathers of the church who dealt with the problem of his own sexual desire by castrating himself. The church frowned mightily upon that move, and that could be one of the reasons Origen doesn't have the title saint before his name. Nevertheless, Origen wasn't the first or last faithful Catholic who failed to grasp the meaning of sexual desire or how to order it rightly. From church fathers to Sunday school teachers, a good many Catholics couldn't understand, let alone articulate, how something could be both holy and potentially soul-destroying all at the same time. Their failure eventually manifested itself in parish pews, first as confusion and later, post humanae vitae, as the outright rejection of the church's teachings on sexuality, with Catholic sexual practices, both in and out of marriage, becoming the mirror image of their secular counterparts. Then along came the theology of the body. In 1978, before his election to the papacy, Archbishop Karol Wojtyła completed work on a manuscript about the Catholic vision of the human person and spousal love. It was almost ready to go to press when a papal conclave threw a wrench in the archbishop's plans. He found himself elected pope, and the book went on to the back burner. Only, however, for a short time. In September 1979, Pope John Paul II began presenting the text of that book, modified just slightly, during his Wednesday general audiences. He kept presenting the text, small section by small section, with the occasional interruption, for the next 5 years. When he finished, 133 Wednesday audiences later, the Catholic world sat back and went, Some people who had followed the unfolding of the Wednesday audiences with rapt attention were in awe. They had never heard a pope speak with such insight or sensitivity about marital love, and they knew the ramifications of the teachings would be deep and wide. Others were confused. John Paul II's philosophical reasoning was profound but complex. Listening to him deliver the catechesis wasn't easy, and reading the catechesis in print wasn't much different. Then there were the skeptics, the naysayers, the critics, those who thought John Paul II had gone too far or not far enough in talking about the issues at hand. In the years since, things haven't changed much. Passionate enthusiasm, intense criticism, and utter confusion, or some combination thereof, are still the primary responses people have to the theology of the body, which is rather surprising. It's surprising because the heart of the theology of the body is nothing all that new. Again, the theology of the body at its core is an anthropology of what it means to be a human person, made in the image of God. And John Paul II didn't invent that anthropology whole cloth. Rather, his work builds on the Trinitarian theology of St. John Chrysostom and the Carmelite spirituality of St. John of the Cross, the systematic theology of St. Thomas Aquinas and Reginald Garrigou-Lagrange, the phenomenologically rooted reflections on the feminine of St. Edith Stein, and the personalism of Dietrich von Hildebrand, the wisdom of King Solomon, the Desert Fathers, and the medieval mystics, plus any number of other theologians, fathers, doctors, and philosophers, all figure into John Paul II's thought, predating it from anywhere to 30 to 3,000 years. The catechesis itself, drawing on the richness of Catholic theology and philosophy, gives us the same picture of the world found in the Sistine Chapel or the Song of Songs. It's a world where matter is a vehicle for grace, where the fallen can become holy, and where everything, not just including the human body, but especially the human body, speaks of God. Essentially, what the theology of the body gives us is an articulation of the Catholic sacramental worldview with a special focus on the human person. More precisely, the theology of the body is the sacramental worldview, restructured and rearticulated for a generation plagued by a diseased understanding of the cosmos. It's that structuring and articulation, more than the picture itself, that's new. It's how John Paul II uses the language of personalist philosophy and makes the human body the point of entry for a recovery of the sacramental worldview that makes the theology of the body so singular. It's also that presentation and structure that makes the theology of the body so effective. As Damon Owens, president of the Theology of the Body Institute, explained in a 2012 interview, the theology of the body gives us a language. When we speak about love, marriage, and relationships, when we speak about our love of God, it's in personal terms, not legal terms. And that's jolting to many people. It's never occurred to them that we can be in love with God and see Him in all creation. Equally important is that it allows us to touch people where they're most broken, in terms of identity and relationships. The theology of the body resonates with people's own experience. To get more specific, while not everyone may understand what terms such as primary end and secondary end mean, most everyone knows what it feels like to use and be used, experience shame, or long to give themselves in love to another. Use, shame, gift. Those are the words of John Paul II's theology of the body. They're words to which people can relate. They're words people can understand. They're words that speak to the experience of their lives and the longings of their heart, which means they actually communicate the truths about love and sexuality the Church has long been trying to communicate and which people need to hear. And that takes us back to modernism, Humanae Vitae, and the necessity of the theology of the body. Michael Waldstein writes, "All the fundamental questions of our age, questions about the meaning of the body, about the meaning of love, about nature, technology, and progress, come together in the issue of Humanae Vitae as in a tight knot. In order to understand these questions, one needs an integral vision of man." John Paul II's theology of the body gives us that integral vision. From the starting point of human experience, it looks at what it means to be a human person and what it means to love, enabling us to respond to the challenges of modernism and see the world with Catholic eyes once more. And that brings us to the next question at hand. What does that integral vision entail?